Chapter 2. Behind his back, his body was sore all over from the many blows with sticks and butts of muskets which had hurried him along on the painful road from the place of his capture to the gate of the fort. This was the only kind of systematic attention the prisoners had received from their escort during a 4 days' journey across a scantily watered tract of country. At the crossings of rare streams they were permitted to quench their thirst by lapping hurriedly like dogs. In the evening a few scraps of meat were thrown amongst them as they dropped down dead beat upon the stony ground of the halting place. As he stood in the courtyard of the castle in the early morning, after having been driven hard all night, Gasparuz's throat was parched, and his tongue felt very large and dry in his mouth. And Gasparuz, besides being very thirsty, was stirred by a feeling of sluggish anger, which he could not very well express, as though the vigor of his spirit were by no means equal to the strength of his body. The other prisoners in the batch of the condemned hung their heads, looking obstinately on the ground. But Gasparuz kept on repeating, "Colon, what should I desert for to the royalists? Why should I desert? Tell me, Esteban." He addressed himself to the sergeant, who happened to belong to the same part of the country as himself. But the sergeant, after shrugging his meager shoulders once, paid no further attention to the deep murmuring voice at his back. It was indeed strange that Gasparuz should desert. His people were in too humble a station to feel much the disadvantages of any form of government. There was no reason why Gasparuz should wish to uphold in his own person the rule of the King of Spain. Neither had he been anxious to exert himself for its subversion. He had joined the side of independence in an extremely reasonable and natural manner. A band of patriots appeared one morning early, surrounding his father's ranch, spearing the watchdogs and hamstringing a fat cow all in the twinkling of an eye, to the cries of "Viva la Libertad!" Their officer discoursed of liberty with enthusiasm and eloquence after a long and refreshing sleep. When they left in the evening, taking with them some of Ruz, the father's best horses to replace their own lamed animals, Gasparuz went away with them, having been invited pressingly to do so by the eloquent officer. Shortly afterwards a detachment of royalist troops coming to pacify the district, burnt the ranch, carried off the remaining horses and cattle, and having thus deprived the old people of all their worldly possessions, left them sitting under a bush in the enjoyment of the inestimable boon of life. 2. Gasparuz, condemned to death as a deserter, was not thinking either of his native place, or of his parents, to whom he had been a good son on account of the mildness of his character, and the great strength of his limbs. The practical advantage of this last was made still more valuable to his father by his obedient disposition. Gasparuz had an acquiescent soul, but it was stirred now to a sort of dim revolt by his dislike to die the death of a traitor. He was not a traitor. He said again to the sergeant, "Colon, you know I did not desert, Esteban. You know I remained behind amongst the trees with three others, to keep the enemy back, while the detachment was running away. Lieutenant Santiera, little more than a boy at the time, and unused as yet to the sanguinary imbecilities of a state of war, had lingered nearby, as if fascinated by the sight of these men who were to be shot presently, or an example as the commandant had said." The sergeant, without deigning to look at the prisoner, addressed himself to the young officer with a superior smile. 10 men would not have been enough to make him a prisoner, M.I.T.N.I.N.D. Moreover, the other 3 rejoined the detachment after dark. Why should he, unwounded and the strongest of them all, have failed to do so? "My strength is as nothing against a mounted man with a lasso," Gasparuz protested, eagerly. He dragged me behind his horse for half a mile. At this excellent reason the sergeant only laughed contemptuously. The young officer hurried away after the commandant. Presently the adjutant of the castle came by. He was a truculent, raw-boned man in a ragged uniform. His spluttering voice issued out of a flat yellow face. The sergeant learned from him that the condemned man would not be shot till sunset. He begged then to know what he was to do with the meantime. The adjutant looked savagely around the courtyard, and, pointing to the door of a small dungeon-like guardroom, receiving light and air through one heavily barred window, said, "Colon, drive the scoundrels in there." The sergeant, tightening his grip upon the stick he carried in virtue of his rank, executed this order with alacrity and zeal. He hit Gasparuz, whose movements were slow, over his head and shoulders. Gasparuz stood still for a moment under the shower of blows, biting his lip thoughtfully, as if absorbed by a perplexing mental process, then followed the others without haste. The door was locked, and the adjutant carried off the key. By noon the heat of that vaulted place crammed to suffocation had become unbearable. The prisoners crowded towards the window, begging their guards for a drop of water, but the soldiers remained lying in indolent attitudes, wherever there was a little shade under a wall, while the sentry sat with his back against the door smoking a cigarette, and raising his eyebrows philosophically from time to time. Gasparuz had pushed his way to the window with irresistible force. His capacious chest needed more air than the others. His big face, resting with its chin on the ledge, pressed close to the bars, seemed to support the other faces crowding up for breath. From moaned entreaties they had passed to desperate cries, and the tumultuous howling of those thirsty men obliged a young officer who was just then crossing the courtyard to shout in order to make himself heard, "Why don't you give some water to these prisoners?" The sergeant, with an air of surprised innocence, excused himself by the remark that all those men were condemned to die in a very few hours. Lieutenant Santiera stamped his foot. "They are condemned to death, not to torture," he shouted. "Give them some water at once." Impressed by this appearance of anger, the soldiers bestirred themselves, and the sentry, snatching up his musket, stood to attention. But when a couple of buckets were found and filled from the well, it was discovered that they could not be passed through the bars, which were set too close. At the prospect of quenching their thirst, the shrieks of those trampled down in the struggle to get near the opening became very heartrending. But when the soldiers who had lifted the buckets towards the window put them to the ground again helplessly, the yell of disappointment was still more terrible. The soldiers of the Army of Independence were not equipped with canteens. A small tin cup was found, but its approach to the opening caused such a commotion, such yells of rage and pain in the vague mass of limbs behind the straining faces at the window, that Lieutenant Santiera cried out hurriedly, "No, no, you must open the door, Sergeant." The sergeant, shrugging his shoulders, explained that he had no right to open the door, even if he had had the key. But he had not the key. The adjutant of the garrison kept the key. Those men were giving much unnecessary trouble, since they had to die at sunset in any case. Why they had not been shot at once early in the morning he could not understand. Lieutenant Santiera kept his back studiously to the window. It was at his earnest solicitations that the commandant had delayed the execution. This favor had been granted to him in consideration of his distinguished family and of his father's high position amongst the chiefs of the Republican Party. Lieutenant Santiera believed that the general commanding would visit the fort sometime in the afternoon, and he ingenuously hoped that his naive intercession would induce that severe man to pardon some, at least, of those criminals. In the revulsion of his feeling, his interference stood revealed now as guilty and futile meddling. It appeared to him obvious that the general would never even consent to listen to his petition. He could never save those men, and he had only made himself responsible for the sufferings added to the cruelty of their fate. "Then go at once, and get the key from the adjutant," said Lieutenant Santiera. The sergeant shook his head with a sort of bashful smile, while his eyes glanced sideways at Gasparuz's face, motionless and silent, staring through the bars at the bottom of a heap of other haggard, distorted, yelling faces. "His worship the adjutant de plaza," the sergeant murmured, was having his siesta, and supposing that he, the sergeant, would be allowed access to him, the only result he expected would be to have his soul flogged out of his body for presuming to disturb his worship's repose. He made a deprecatory movement with his hands, and stood stock still, looking down modestly upon his brown toes. Lieutenant Santiera glared with indignation, but hesitated. His handsome oval face, as smooth as a girl's, flushed with the shame of his perplexity. Its nature humiliated his spirit. His hairless upper lip trembled. He seemed on the point of either bursting into a fit of rage or into tears of dismay. 50 years later, General Santiera, the venerable relic of revolutionary times, was well able to remember the feelings of the young lieutenant. Since he had given up riding altogether, and found it difficult to walk beyond the limits of his garden, the general's greatest delight was to entertain in his house the officers of the foreign men of war visiting the harbor. For Englishmen he had a preference, as for old companions in arms. English naval men of all ranks accepted his hospitality with curiosity, because he had known Lord Cochrane, and had taken part, on board the Patriot squadron commanded by that marvelous seaman, in the cutting out and blockading operations before Callao, an episode of unalloyed glory in the Wars of Independence, and of endless honor in the fighting tradition of Englishmen. He was a fair linguist, this ancient survivor of the liberating armies. A trick of smoothing his long white beard, whenever he was short of a word in French or English, imparted an air of leisurely dignity to the tone of his reminiscences. "Three, yes, my friends," he used to say to his guests, "what would you have? A youth of 17 summers, without worldly experience, and owing my rank only to the glorious patriotism of my father, may God rest his soul. I suffered immense humiliation, not so much from the disobedience of that subordinate, who, after all, was responsible for those prisoners, but I suffered because, like the boy I was, I myself dreaded going to the adjutant for the key. I had felt, before, his rough and cutting tongue. Being quite a common fellow, with no merit except his savage valor, he made me feel his contempt and dislike from the first day I joined my battalion in garrison at the fort. It was only a fortnight before. I would have confronted him sword in hand, but I shrank from the mocking brutality of his sneers. I don't remember having been so miserable in my life before or since. The torment of my sensibility was so great that I wished the sergeant to fall dead at my feet, and the stupid soldiers who stared at me to turn into corpses, and even those wretches for whom my entreaties had procured a reprieve I wished dead also, because I could not face them without shame. A mephitic heat like a whiff of air from hell came out of that dark place in which they were confined. Those at the window who had heard what was going on jeered at me in very desperation. One of these fellows, gone mad no doubt, kept on urging me volubly to order the soldiers to fire through the window. His insane loquacity made my heart turn faint, and my feet were like lead. There was no higher officer to whom I could appeal. I had not even the firmness of spirit to simply go away. Benumbed by my remorse, I stood with my back to the window. You must not suppose that all this lasted a long time. How long could it have been? A minute? If you measured by mental suffering, it was like 100 years, a longer time than all my life has been since. No, certainly, it was not so much as a minute. The hoarse screaming of those miserable wretches died out in their dry throats, and then suddenly a voice spoke, a deep voice muttering calmly. It called upon me to turn round. That voice, sinners, proceeded from the head of Gasparuz. Of his body I could see nothing. Some of his fellow captives had clambered upon his back. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.